This is an ABC podcast.
F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote a great piece on cracking up. It happens to people and to civilizations, and the signs are not good. Hi, I'm Amanda Vanstone. This is Counterpoint, where we offer some counterintuitive ideas. Now, speaking of cracking up, some Italians might get a bit tense if you were blatantly direct with them about the multicultural history of their food. Purely Italian is not all it's cracked up to be. In great news, local rats have been reintroduced into North Head Sanctuary, and they are going gangbusters. The idea is that if something was once there, it had a purpose for being there, and the native rats do a great job. Good on them for being returned. But first to war, we have to start wanting to win, not just to survive and support our mates. Why do we go to war? You know, it's not a pleasant decision to make. Sending the sons and daughters of Australians, or in any country, the sons and daughters of your country, overseas, risking their lives. And you'd think you only do that when you're completely desperate, as in it's a war you have to win. But there is an argument that Australia has been in wars too often not about winning. So let's talk to someone who knows a bit more about it. Peter Layton is a visiting fellow at the Griffith Asia Institute. He's an associate fellow at RUSI in the United Kingdom and a fellow of the Australian Security Leaders Climate Group. He knows a bit about this and he joins us now. Peter Layton, when did Australia last fight a war where we needed to win?
So we last fought a war that we had to win between about the start of 1942 and the middle of 1943. And of course, that was when the Japanese attacked. And so we didn't have a choice there. We were forced into a major war.
Yeah. And you would say since then we haven't had to win, really? We've been fighting for other reasons.
We've been fighting for politics. Now, all wars are about politics. But from the middle of 1943 onwards until the end of the Second World War, our last major sort of great war, if you like, we were fighting for a seat at the peace table so that we could win the peace, if you like, and get some victories in that peace war settlement. After that, we were fighting to reinforce and support our alliance with the US. Now, that's not to say that's a bad thing, because after all, we've had sort of 80 years of effectively peace and plenty. The wars that we've been involved in have been, from our point of view, minor and a long way away. And Australia's done very well. But times are perhaps changing, and we need to have a think now, not about minor wars for politics and reinforcing alliances, but rather thinking about wars that we will really need to win, just as we did back in 1942.
Yeah, okay. Now, you say, in a sense, with those wars when we didn't need to win, the enemy was almost irrelevant. And you go on and say, I thought it was a great way to put it, which was pretty good, because since 43, the quality of victories has been steadily declining. There's not many articles where you read the quality of victories has been declining, but what's a quick history of the quality of those victories that you outline?
Well, I suppose if you step back and you sort of sum them all up, to a certain extent, we have won every battle but lost every war. In the Korean War, at the end of the war, saw pretty much where we were at the start of the war. There was a ceasefire. In fact, the ceasefire still goes on. But in the Vietnam, after 20 years of effort, the North Vietnamese won. So that was sort of hardly a victory. The wars in the Middle East, they've rambled on and ruffled on for sort of years and years. But fighting the Iraqis was never a particularly satisfactory conflict, even though the historians today will look back and say, well, it hasn't ended up as badly as it could have. That's about the best that you could say there. Because the Iraqis are friends of a kind, but the Middle East is very disturbed. The Afghanistan war, again, after 20 years of expending blood and treasure, the bad guys seem to have won. And disturbingly, I mean, this was a country of 44 million people, was taken over by a ragtag army of about 150,000 by the Taliban. It almost seems as though the Afghans as a whole, not as individuals, but as a whole, preferred the Taliban to us. So those wars have been big successes from the Australian viewpoint. We've reinforced our alliance with the United States. And it's become an oxymoron, I suppose, we say each year that our alliance has never been the better. But I think that there's some truth in that.
Let me just ask you this. People have said so often since World War II, never again. And yet it's happened. And Russia's recent invasion of Ukraine reminds us all that, you know, rationality doesn't always apply when people are making these decisions. So you look at what's happening, you look at the threat of a US-China war, and you say, well, I say, well, look, surely that's just like companies that are too big to fail, that's too big to contemplate, and either side would realise the devastation that would be unleashed. But, you know, Russia's invasion of the Ukraine says to us, don't look at these things and work out what would be sensible, because when people make these decisions, they're largely not.
It certainly changes people's minds. I mean, all of us were convinced that Putin would never invade. That would just be a crazy move. I have to say, I think all of us were in fact right, but Putin did invade, and this very ugly war, which is costing hundreds of thousands of people their lives, goes on. And you can see a microcosm, but I wouldn't want to drag this out too far, but there's this balloon crisis going on. Okay, the Americans are clearly trying to use their crisis management techniques, use their hotlines into a China and tamp the crisis down and defuse the situation. But the Americans are calling, but the Chinese are not answering the phone calls. The Chinese, for some reason, decided they'll keep this going. And that very big difference about crisis management there that goes back to President Putin. Other people may want to do things that we don't find rational at all.
Yeah. Now, you say that, and I think quite rightly, we can't really outsource worrying about winning to others, namely the United States. But what do you mean when you go on to say that the imagined future we look at is not the past?
It's because we're all victims of a history, if you like, and I think we sort of tend to look at the defence force and how we've done it for the last 80 years as how we'll do it for the next 80 years. And to a certain degree over the last 80 years, the military and the civil side of Australia have got separated as the military has gone off to fight these particular wars of the state. So when you start talking about fighting wars that you must win, it's not just a job for the military, if you like. It involves society also. So there's that important part about mobilising people and having everybody, if you like, working on the same hymn sheet.
And you're not hugely positive either, are you, about the recent acquisitions, the Black Hawk helicopters and the C-130J transport aircraft buys? You say, you know, it's just back in the past stuff.
Well, I mean, I have to say both of those, you know, were fine aircraft back in the 1980s. But when you look at the future and you look at the Ukraine war and you're talking, you know, drones and robots and long-range fires and precision-guided missiles and all the high-tech stuff, and there's a lot of high-tech stuff going on with the software and command and control systems, and you think, are we stuck in this vision of, if you like, of the Vietnam War? Black Hawk helicopters and C-130s would have been fine for the Vietnam War.
Well, you've done something that's really important, Peter, and that is you've made people think. There's nothing better than a good old think rather than just accepting what we get dished up daily and thinking about going to war to win as opposed to support others is a good idea. Thanks very much for joining us on Counterpoint.
Thank you very much for having me, Amanda.
It takes a lot more than the talk of war to make people crack up, but crack up we do, as civilizations do. How does it come about that you feel as if you're falling apart? Are you falling apart because of pressures from outside, or are you falling apart from within? And you might ask the same about civilizations. How does that happen that they are great big empires at one point? And then, boom, they're gone. I don't know if it's like, who said bankruptcy? Comes at you slowly and then all of a sudden, whack. Now, to talk about this, we're going to talk to Peter Hughes. We've spoken to him before. He's a philosopher and psychologist, and he wrote The History of Love and Hate in 21 Statues. And he joins us now from the United Kingdom. Peter Hughes, are you an F. Scott Fitzgerald fan?
Yeah, I am. I love F. Scott Fitzgerald's work. And particularly, you know, his wonderful 1935 article that he wrote in Esquire, not the most well-known of his works, but it's called The Crack-Up. And at that time in his life, he was in a really, really dark place, you know, and he described himself as lost, spent, dissipated. He mm-hmm. felt his whole identity was breaking apart. You know, he was holed up in a hotel in North Carolina. He was living on tinned food. He was on the edge of bankruptcy. His finances were a complete mess. He reckoned he was down to his last few cents. His wife, Zelda, was in an asylum. There's a great anecdote, actually, that one day they let Zelda out of the asylum to go with Scott on some kind of walk. But during the course of the walk, for some reason, he had to prevent her from throwing herself under a train. And then, as a real symptom of a complete psychosis, she demanded, get me back to the asylum, lock me up again before the moon comes up. And so that's the life that Fitzgerald had in the mid-1930s. And his literary agent, Harold Obert, said Fitzgerald's never sober. And even a casual acquaintance, a Mrs. Guthrie, who was his typist, reckoned he drank 20 bottles of beer in an evening. But The Crack-Up, this particular article that he wrote around this time, is where he makes a really powerful distinction. And he said, there's two types of crack-up. There's the blows, he said, the kind of blows that come, or he says, seem to come from outside. And then there's another type of blow, he said, the type that comes from within. And you don't realize you've cracked until it's too late. And that's really the one that drove his own behavior and drove this particular brilliant piece of writing.
Mm. Well, I was fascinated why he chose to include the anecdote about Ernest Hemingway, who apparently saw shame and cowardice in Fitzgerald's, as you describe it, confessional essay, and what he went on and offered to do. Can you share that with us?
Yeah, well, Hemingway was not one for great sympathy with a lack of masculinity in men. So he said, horrified by this exercise and what he saw was a self-indulgent self-pity on behalf of Fitzgerald, Hemingway wrote to him and said, look, I'll arrange to have you killed. Let's get it over with. I'll arrange to have you killed. You can be killed in Cuba. That'll be good, Hemingway said, because your wife, Zelda, and your daughter, Scotty, will both benefit from your insurance policy. And then in a wonderful phrase, Hemingway said, look, and I'll write a fine obituary for you. And then he said, in a rather stunning turn of phrase, if we can still find your balls, I will take them via the Ile de France to Paris and down to Antibes and cast them into the sea off Eden Rock. So he really did have contempt for Fitzgerald's essay. But, you know, in the essay itself, Fitzgerald describes what a critic once said to him and said, look, don't, you know, blame yourself for all this stuff. You know, stop focusing on yourself. Why don't you find an external cause? Like maybe blame all your problems on a crack in a Grand Canyon or some random event. And that really, when it comes not just to our own individual mental health, but also to the health of civilizations and cultures, we have a choice. We either sit down and we say, okay, I can take responsibility for this and I can do my best to get myself out of it, or I can simply point the finger. And there was a wonderful Russian essayist, he emigrated to the United States, called Joseph Brodsky. And he once famously said, in a lecture actually, to a university where his daughter was studying in the United States, beware, he said, of your index finger, because it is blame thirsty, because it's always pointing at somebody else. It's your fault. It's your fault. It's your fault. Yeah. And somebody recently once commented, some comedian, I can't remember his name, an American comedian, but he said that therapy used to be you'd go and see a therapist to say, well, look, you know, I've got these problems. I want you to help me sort them out. Now you go to a therapist and you say, well, you know, I've got these problems, but I don't know who to blame. So I hope you can sort out a hierarchy of blame for me so I can work out who's actually responsible for the way I feel. And that shows on a cultural level what's happened to us. That is profoundly psychologically unhealthy. It's narcissistic, it's grandiose, and it's deeply unhealthy. And it is equally unhealthy on an individual basis. You can never, ever recover from anything that you have no control over. So if it's always somebody else's fault, it's always something external to you, then you cannot do anything to mitigate against it. You stand yourself in the position of a perpetual victim, pointing the finger.
Have you read much of Theodore Dalrymple, in particular his book Life at the Bottom?
Yeah, I know.
There's a fantastic bit in there where, when he's working as a prison psychiatrist, and this murderer comes in and says, "It's not me, Doc. You know, I'm not well. Yeah. It's not my fault. You've got to fix me."
Yeah.
And he asks him, "Did you go to the guy's house Yes, deliberately, yes. Did you have a knife in your pocket? Yes. Why don't you have your knife? Oh, in case there was an argument. I mean, it all went on and on and on. But look, I do like Scott Fitzgerald's critic who says, by God, if I ever cracked up, I'd try to make the word crack with me. I thought that was pretty good. But let's get on to the extension of this, because you talk about a French poet of whom I had not previously heard, Paul Valéry.
Paul Valéry, yep.
Yeah, okay. Yep. And he says, a civilization has the same fragility as a life. Now, let's go on from there.
Yeah, and that's true. And what happens to the individual, breaking up from the inside and not really finding out until it's too late, that happens to civilizations. Civilizations break apart, and it's happening to us. And one of the great, really, historians or scientists who tried to make sense of this was a guy called Peter Turchin, and he developed a theory called cleodynamics, which is Cleo after the Greek goddess of history, meaning to try and put some science and to see some mathematical patterns in history. And he used the work of a medieval Islamic philosopher called Ibn Khaldun. And the concept that Khaldun came up with was asabiyya. And that means like a capacity of a social group for cohesion and collective action to a common goal. And he said, when a civilization loses that, when it starts fighting, when the battles it's fighting are within its identity, rather than between identities, or between this civilization and another civilization, then a civilization has reached the point of complete collapse and a complete loss of order. And there are a number of symptoms of that, according to Turchin. And this is really interesting, because he says that one of the key things that happens when civilizations end up teetering on the brink of collapse is elites start becoming very remote from the mass of people. And they start competing amongst themselves for diminishing resources. These could be material resources like wealth and power, but they could also be things like status. And when that happens, a society is really not only on the verge of collapse, but it's already collapsed.
I hope that's not entirely true, I have to say, because look around. I mean, we can see that everywhere.
We can see it everywhere, right? And before we come to the modern day, just look at the Roman Empire. In the early Roman Republic, maybe the richest 1% of Romans were about 10 times wealthier than the average Roman. But by the late Empire, that was more than 100, maybe 110, 120 times richer than the average Roman. And when that inequality stretched, and then the elites began competing amongst themselves for status and power, then collapse became inevitable. And of course, that's where we are now. How much cohesion, how much asabiyya, if you want, is there in American society today?
Yeah. You mentioned a fellow called George Putnam, again, who I had not heard of, who in 1589 had some pretty good advice about the circle of life. Can you share that with us?
Yeah, he does. And Putnam, again, is quoted by Tolkien. And Putnam's quote is fantastic. He said, peace makes plenty. Plenty makes pride. Pride breeds quarrel. And quarrel breeds war. War brings spoil, and spoil poverty. Poverty, patience, and patience, peace. So peace brings war, and war brings peace. And that cycle that Putnam describes there.
There it is.
There it is in a nutshell, right? When a society gets richer and richer and richer, when it's on an upward curve, everything seems well and everybody's happy. But then those resources get scarcer and scarcer and scarcer, both material resources and also resources like status and power. Then competition happens within that society and inequality escalates. Then things begin to collapse. And then there's civil war. And then that reduces things back to a much simpler form of social organization. And the cycle begins all over again.
That was Hannah Arendt's theory, in one of them anyway, in a book called Treatise, Revolution, that it's called revolution because you go back. That's what the French Revolution was. Here these people have grown a bit above themselves, so the crowd are going to get touchy about that and go and behead them and, you know, start again.
Yeah, I mean, but the French Revolution is a classic in this, really, because where did the French Revolution start? It started with the great ideals, you know, of liberty. You know, fraternity, equality, and it was casting aside the old order, but we must be really wary of ideologies that are utopian to the core. Remember, what was the republic that the French Revolution was going to end up in? It was called the Republic of Virtue. But where did it end up? It ended up running out of guillotines because there were so many people to behead. Literally, the gutters and the sewers were running with blood. And this kind of utopian ideology is detached from reality. And it's what happens when things reach a point of terminal decline, when people lose touch with reality, when they believe in this utopia somewhere in the future. But to get to that utopia, what do they have to do? They have to kill, they have to behead, they have to torment and torture and destroy and ruin and devastate those who do not agree with their ideology, do not agree with their worldview. And that is exactly the parallel to what happens on an individual level when it comes to mental health. It's like trying to get back to sanity and to some kind of mental equilibrium by constantly pointing the finger out. But what happens is you don't get any better, because the more things and people and institutions outside yourself that you destroy, the more you need to destroy, because you're mistaking the locus of the problem. The problem is you. The problem's on the inside. And your refusal to see that means that your cruelty and your violence becomes endless.
Peter, do you recall ever reading a book called When the Sons of Heaven Meet the Daughters of the Earth?
I don't actually, no.
It's a novel, yeah. And it's about a pharmaceutical heiress and the guy she marries in the United States and how corrupt the art market is there. And he's a bit fed up with being the sort of toy boy to the rich wife and gets his brain completely addled on alcohol and drugs. And at one point he says, liberty, fraternity and equality, don't they realise they're mutually inconsistent terms?
Right.
I thought I'd leave you with that as something to think about, because you've left us with a lot to think about. Peter Hughes, thanks for joining us again on Counterpoint.
Thanks very much, Amanda. My pleasure.
And we'll post a link to the F. Scott Fitzgerald essay on cracking up from the 1930s on our website. Oh, the rat. You know, you've heard me complain before about those people that complain, complain, complain. And I thought, well, hold on, I do that a bit with the rant, complain, complain, complain. And I think I've thought of a way to deal with people that have always got something negative to say. You can just say to them, now, what good news have you got today? And then shut up. Just say nothing. Keep staring at them. The ball's coming back there into the court. They have to do something with it. And what good news do you have today? Or you could say, now let's talk about the good things in your life. What are the best two? Just take charge. Instead of accepting all this negative rubbish that people chuck at you, take charge. Let's talk about the good things in your life. What are they? It's true, I don't like people complaining, but frankly, when the Italians complain, I could just listen all day. They're gorgeous. Having spent some time in Italy, I can assure you the Italians love their food. They're very proud of their food. As one of them said to me, why would we have restaurants from other countries? We have the best food in the world. Okay, you think, righto. You know, saying that to an Australian who comes from a very multicultural food environment, it's a bit of a surprise in Italy how reluctant they are to have a Chinese or a Thai restaurant. Nonetheless, what if I told you that Italian food isn't really Italian? Or more to the point, what if I told an Italian that? Well, let's have a talk about that. We're going to talk with John Last. He's a freelance journalist and he lives in Padua. He knows a fair bit about it. And he's written a piece for Noema magazine called There Is No Such Thing as Italian Food. He joins us now. John Last, what's your favourite Italian food?
Ooh, that's a good question. There's a restaurant in my neighbourhood that, like a lot of really good Italian restaurants, it's very seasonal, so its menu changes all the time. But I just know whenever I go there, whatever I get off the menu is going to be amazing, whether it's a dessert or a secondi or a primi. Even the grappa is good, you know, and grappa is an acquired taste. So I would...
Yes, it's also very strong.
Name the osteria. Yes, it is very strong, for sure.
It is very strong. But come on, one dish that you think, gee, I hope they have that on today.
Well, I'm always partial to spaghetti carbonara, I have to say. I mean, it's infiltrated into Canada, that one. You know, I remember learning how to make spaghetti carbonara from my dad because it was a quick 30-minute meal. But, you know, Italians get very precious about the right way to cook carbonara, so I'm always afraid to cook it for my Italian friends.
But you don't add cream, do you?
No, never. Never cream.
No, some people
only
do,
ever
of course.
Cook in the bacon fat, right?
Yeah. But some people will tell you, no, you must have cream. I'm like, no. Okay, now let's get on to the topic. Italian food coming from other places. What are some good examples of food that everyday Italians would regard as Italian, but actually comes from other places, you know, centuries ago?
Well, it's almost everything that you can think of, because, of course, Italian food at its core is fresh local ingredients produced in season in a simple fashion with some pasta. But if we break that down, you know, pasta in Italy is made with durum wheat, which was brought to Italy by the Arabs and cultivated at a large scale during the Arab conquest. And then, you know, those vegetables. Well, what are some common vegetables you get in pasta in Italy? Well, there's bell peppers, which come from North America.
Do you know where the tomato comes from?
Of course, yeah. The tomato comes from South America as well.
Well, there you go.
Exactly. You have the very sort of cornerstones of Italian cooking. I mean, even pizza, which we know of as the sort of most Italian product imaginable. Most recipes in Italy for pizza call for something called Manitoba flour, which is a hearty variety of flour made from wheat that comes from North America. It's almost ubiquitous, the number of ingredients that come from places other than Italy.
Italians, of course, might not recognize that, but what you said in the beginning is what really took me, that the essence of Italian food. When people ask me to describe it, because I spent a few years there, I would say, just as you did, it's locally produced, fresh food, prepared simply and quickly. That's the essence of it. I mean, there's some slow-cooked dishes, sure, but largely it's good food, simply and freshly presented. That's the essence of it. But they don't see it that way. Have you run this idea past many of your neighbours in Padua? And how does it go down when you have this discussion, or don't you have it?
I think it's interesting that, you know, one thing that Italians appreciate perhaps more than North Americans and perhaps even more than Australians is that the cooking of a dish doesn't really start when you have your ingredients in the kitchen and you cut them up and put them in a pan. It starts with the person who's growing the vegetable. And in Italy, the process of perfecting your fruit or your vegetables, your ingredients, requires centuries of artisanal skill. You know, it's people who have taken plants and cultivated them over generations to make something that's so unique that, you know, the European Union can slap a label on it and say, you can only get this in this small Italian village. So that's, I think, why they don't think of their cooking as simple by nature. Because, of course, they know that you have to get the exact right ingredient for it to taste correct. And you can't just go to the supermarket and get any old fruit or any old vegetable and produce the same thing.
That's true. I mean, there are villages that might have their specialty that relate to fish. For example, one of the things I discovered in Italy was a fondness for putting zucchini with fish. But you get one village does it with clams, another does it with, you know, the equivalent of whiting or flathead, and each regards it as an iconic dish when essentially it's seafood and zucchini and not much difference between it. I mean, there's a bit of garlic in there, a bit of chili maybe, but it's essentially the same. But they tend to, if you like, to exaggerate the differences. Do you agree with that?
I think there's a lot of that for sure. Part of that goes back to that thing of, you know, Italy is one of the most biodiverse climates in Europe, and it's one of the most biodiverse countries in the world. It has so many different kinds of ecosystems from north to south because it's long and thin and surrounded by two temperate seas. And that biodiversity means that a plant grown in one place isn't really the same as a plant grown in another place, even the same kind of plant. And you get the same sort of attitude around fish and all of that kind of stuff. I have to confess, you know, what makes me probably the worst Venetian imaginable is that I don't really care for fish, no matter where I'm having it. I've been some of the best seafood places in the world, and I just can't get my head around it. But it's funny because fish is a classic example of what we're talking about. You know, most fish recipes, you take the fish out of the sea, you make sure it's fresh, you maybe add some lemon and some salt and a few simple flavors, and you cook it up, and it's really about whether or not the fish itself was good to begin with.
Yeah, that is a good part of it. You know, you get lousy tasting fish, like freshwater fish, and it's muddy tasting. It's no good at all. So what we covered first up is the degree to which migration around the globe and immigration to Italy from Africa, for example, or even from China up north, around Florence and Prato. There's a lot of Chinese immigration there, but also affected by climate change. What are the sorts of things that are happening now in Italy where they might not be able to grow some things they were able to grow, but are now able to grow some things that in the past they couldn't?
Yeah, well, this story really started with the summer last year, which was so devastating in terms of its drought. Yet risotto crops, which are, you know, risotto is a staple of the Italian diet. It's obviously also a local delicacy in the north where a lot of the varieties are. Those crops were dying out at such a level that they had never seen before. You know, some farmers were losing 60% of their crop. In the Po Valley, which produces a lot of the wheat and other vegetables that, you know, are staples in Italian life, that the Po Valley was losing 30% of its entire output. So in Sicily, you have this event called the cascala, which is, you know, fruit suddenly dropping off of the tree because of extreme drought or horrible tropical storms. So you have these crops that are iconically associated with the island, you know, lemon or like blood oranges, things that have been staples of Sicilian cuisine for centuries that are no longer viable at the same scale as they once were. And those by new fruits that are maybe more familiar to African farmers or Central American farmers. So you have things like avocados, which can be grown in the volcanic soil around Mount Etna. You have bananito bananas, which are these tiny little bananas, and mangoes and papaya. And these are ingredients that aren't familiar to Italians. You know, they aren't used to seeing them in the market. But what's interesting is that at the moment, they're only able to be grown on this very small local scale. So the first place they're entering into Italian sort of culinary culture, it's not like I can get them at my market, but a Sicilian can get it as a local Sicilian product that they know comes from their farmer. And that will have lots of, I think, implications for the future of Italian cuisine.
Indeed. When you were talking about fish, it made me think of very common fish served in Italy as swordfish, usually grilled lemon butter on top or something. You know, Australians were, and probably still are, exporting kingfish to Italy. I'm sure some of it's being sold as swordfish. But the problem was with the quality of the swordfish they could get. They didn't think, oh, we need more, we better go to Australia. They wanted quality and they weren't getting it from wherever they were getting it locally. Or there was a shortage of it in the oceans either side of Italy. And that's how we got a great export into Italy. And I can remember when I was there, the chef saying, there's no way you'll be able to bring a fish from Australia and have it here as good as fresh fish here. That's what she said. So the exporter said, well, let me try. I'll send you one. And they flew it to Milan. It came down on road trip in ice. And I can still remember her smacking the knife down on the counter saying, I don't know how they did this. It's better than I can get back home. It's really, really fresh. I mean,
deeply traumatizing for an Italian.
Well, no, she was an Australian. We used to take an Australian chef over.
Okay, good.
To give young chefs the experience of, you know, working in an embassy and being responsible for the whole menu as opposed to cooking the desserts for a month or something, and to bring back Italian cooking skills. Okay, so we're moving on. Now we're growing coffee in Italy as well, I understand.
Yes, there's this roastery in Sicily called Moratino Coffee. It's run by this family that's been operating this roastery for 100 years. And in that entire time, almost, there has been this dream of creating an indigenous sort of coffee grown on the Sicilian soil. But of course, Sicily is not suited to coffee because it's not hot enough. And recent years with these worsening summers that we've been having have made it possible to grow this heirloom strain first in very, very small amounts, you know, 20 kilograms, 50 kilograms. Every single year, they're getting more and more yield. And those numbers, you know, 20, 50 kilograms, we're not talking about something that's going to replace Lavazza, right? Which is one of the biggest espresso brands in Italy. It gets all of its coffee from Ethiopia, from Central America, from South America. But what you will see is a kind of, and this is their vision, is a local short chain alternative produced in Sicily and marketed for the taste of Sicily, the Sicilian terroir, which is, you know, it's the way that people think about wine in Italy or wine in France even, is the way that they're thinking now about coffee and these other products that can really be made because of climate change. The soil is changing, the environment's changing, and now you're seeing these small sort of producers able to who create these local artisanal products based on crops that used to come from abroad.
Mm. Well, I can't believe I spent all that time in Italy and I had no idea how much kiwi fruit they produce.
Well, that's the success story, right? I mean, kiwi was brought to Italy in the 1970s at a time when, you know, most of the Italians I interviewed for this article, they said when I was growing up, I had never even seen a kiwi fruit. And now it's a protected local product that's produced, you know, over tens of thousands of hectares outside of Rome. And that's because of one sort of agronomist who saw the potential and also did what Italians do. They take a plant from abroad, they take it to Italy, they transform it to the local conditions. And by the end of it all, you know, they have a product that's uniquely Italian and that Italians deeply identify with.
John Last, you've been a pleasure to talk to today, not the least because you've taken something people love to talk about, Italian food, and they know Italians love to talk about it, and you've used that as the medium to highlight for us how fruit and vegetables travel the world and make out like they belong in one place that they didn't start in, and how climate change is making that happen even more. Thanks for joining us.
Anytime.
One thing Italian governments have trouble with is cleaning up the rubbish, especially sometimes around Naples and Sicily. Not good, so there'd be rats everywhere. Not our native rats. We love to hear stories about reintroduced native species and them going well. Well, sadly, they often don't. But often we read those stories when that species is in decline and endangered and every effort's being made to reintroduce it back into the wildlife. What about when the species isn't at risk and you reintroduce it for another reason? Maybe to be a predator on a bad guy. And maybe what we need to understand is if the animal was somewhere in the beginning, there was a reason for it being there. So reintroduce it. And so it is with rats. You know, I live in a city where people on one side of the river talk about having fruit rats. You know, they're not just dirty old rats, they're fruit rats. Well, native rats are, in fact, very cute, small, cuddly, cute-looking things. So let's talk to Aidan Wright. He's a field ecologist for the Australian Wildlife Conservancy based at the North Head Sanctuary and has been right at the forefront of reintroducing the native rats. Aidan Wright, have you cuddled one of these little native rats?
I wouldn't say cuddled, but I've handled a lot of bush rats in my time, and they are a great species to work with, especially when you have other rodents like invasive black rats that are potentially running amok.
Now, we have reintroduced, and you've been part of this plan, to the North Head Sanctuary some native rats, and they've done really well, haven't they?
They have indeed. So the native bush rats at North Head are a bit of a success story of a native doing a good job at reclaiming a bit of land in which they would have been previously. And in the process, they've managed to kick out some of our invasive species that have ended up in our urban areas and their surrounds. And in this instance, that was the introduced European black rat.
Right. So if I look at a picture of North Head and I see the sanctuary at the end and I think, right, there's lovely little native rats there. And the pictures of them do look cute. And those ugly imported black rats have been shoved out into the nearby houses. That does beg the question. I know this is not your field because you're with the Australian Wildlife Conservancy and you're at the North Head Sanctuary. So we're looking at reintroducing this native rat there. But when I see the photo taken from on top and I see all the houses around, I think, well, maybe they'd be better off with native rats too. Is there a chance, has that ever occurred to you, that we could take this idea of reintroducing the native rat to the sanctuary and then give it a go at exploding over Sydney and get rid of the introduced species in other places as well?
Unfortunately, the tricky thing with our native bush rats is they do tend to have a bit of a preference with sticking to their native habitat, so sticking to our nice bushy areas rather than coming into our homes and the areas adjacent to them. Whereas the black rats, and this is part of the reason of why they've been such a successful invader, not just in Australia but globally, is because they do like to come into our urban areas, and that's why you'll find them running about.
Yeah, they lack discrimination. They'll go into garbage bins or anywhere, whereas the native rat prefers something nice and bushy and clean in the environmental sense. So that's fair enough. Now, look, how did this come about? Were there a couple of people sitting on a park bench who said, oh, I know what we could do. We could go and catch some native rats over there and take them over to the North Head Sanctuary. It can't have been that simple. Do you know much about how this happened?
Well, I can speak from the perspective of our organisation. So the Australian Wildlife Conservancy is a global leader in small mammal reintroductions. And so in our sanctuaries and our project areas, our intention is to go in, identify what biodiversity has been lost and do our best to restore some of that biodiversity. Mm-hmm. And typically is on these small mammals. And so the Sydney region, a trend that has been seen across our urban reserves, including North Head, is that native species such as our bush rats have been replaced by these introduced rodents. Yeah.
That's what you do. So you identified the rat as being a good idea, went to a couple of nearby parks to catch some that existed in nearby parks, even though they didn't exist in the North Head Sanctuary. You went and caught some and released them.
Yeah, that's right. So the bush rat, the species in question is, yeah, as we mentioned, a fairly common species along eastern Australia. And so in some of the reserves and national parks surrounding the Sydney region, they're still in good numbers. And so when we realised that they were a good candidate species for reintroduction to North Head, the aim is to go out, source these animals from locations where they are doing well and translocate or relocate them to North Head where they can do their thing and start to repopulate on the headland where we want them.
And did you have to monitor it? It's been going for a couple of years now, hasn't it? I mean, it's not just a one-off, 1 year you've done a test and it's okay. You've been back over a couple of years and the numbers are growing and it's doing well.
That's right. So it's definitely an ongoing process with any reintroduction. And so I guess the first thing that is important is to address the threat. So the main reasons as to why the species has declined in the first place. And in doing so, we were able to control the black rat populations at North Head. And at the same time, while suppressing those numbers, we were able to reintroduce the bush rats to fill that void. And part of our role at North Head and the teams of AWC ecologists that have come before me, we regularly monitor the reintroductions. So we typically do two surveys per year. We do small mammal monitoring across the entire headland. And in that way, we're able to track the capture rates of how the bush rat population was trending. And at the same time, we're able to see the decline in black rats as a result. So with the reintroduction of the bush rats, we started back in 2014. That was when the original founder population was released at North Head. And in the 2 years following, so in 2015 and 2016, we followed up with some supplementation events. So we took additional individuals from some reserves in northern Sydney and continue to boost that original founder population at North Head.
Do you know, one of the things that occurred to me is, do you do this in one night? Imagine, say you release, I don't know, say 50 in the beginning or 70, pick 70 as a notional number. Do you go out on one night and just release 70 of them? They're all running around saying, oh my God, where are we? And have to work out who they're going to be friends with, or do you capture families of native rats and try and put them in an area together, or just open the cage and away you go, guys?
It's not all at once, but sort of in dribs and drabs. So originally the project area where the bush rats were released was a 15-hectare plot, and we used smaller sections of those where up to five animals were released together into these smaller locations within that larger 15 hectares. And it would typically be a mix of about three females and two males.
Now, when you say release into small sections of that larger section of the park, is that fenced off so that you can monitor them?
So there is no fencing at North Head. It's all public access.
Yep.
And so when we do the releases, our monitoring is more just at those specific release locations. So we
just see if they hung around. Yeah. Okay.
Exactly. Yeah. We typically deploy camera traps so we can monitor their comings and goings.
Is it fair to say, Aidan, that even though these native rats aren't at risk, they've done good things? I mean, in addition to getting rid of nearly the black rats, they serve another purpose, don't they? I mean, they're tilling over the soil, they're eating the right bugs, they're keeping nature in balance the way it was meant to be there.
That's right, yeah. The bush rat is just one of three species that the Australian Wildlife Conservancy has reintroduced to North Head. And all three of these species have an important role for the ecological processes up at North Head.
Mm. What are the other two?
So we've also reintroduced eastern pygmy possums. And so they're a tiny marsupial that fit in the palm of your hand. So they're golf ball sized. And as a marsupial, they have pouches. And so often during our studies, we'll come across little pygmy possum mums with little joeys in the pouch. And the other species, the brown antechinus, which again is another marsupial, but this one's actually in the same family as quolls and Tasmanian devils. But the adults often only weigh 20 to 40 grams. And so they're little pocket rockets. They got a bit of a ferocious streak, but their tiny little mouths often aren't big enough to do any damage to humans when you're handling them.
Gee, pocket rockets. Well, full marks to you. I think it's a great story, but, you know, I never would have imagined that one of the great stories about species reintroduction would have been rats. But, you know, at my local beach area, there's a native where there were native rats. I'm not sure what's happened recently because one showed up near a restaurant and used to come and look at the guests. It was cute, little stubby tail thing, not quite as small as the ones you're talking about. And it hasn't appeared lately. I think some guests have complained and the rats have been removed, which is a bad thing if they're native rats. I have to say, Aidan, you're doing a great job. I'm not sure if all Australia's pleased that we're looking after the rats, but I'm sure they'd rather us look after native ones than imported black rats. Thanks for joining us today on Counterpoint.
Thanks, Amanda. Thanks for having me.
That's the program for this week. I hope you enjoyed it. Thanks very much for joining us. And I hope you join us next week for some more counterintuitive ideas about what's happening in the world. By the way, thanks for the feedback. Yes, I know some people don't like some things, but I love the people that do love them. Everyone's like that, don't we? We don't always welcome criticism, but we have to listen to it because it's, you know, free market research. So keep sending your thoughts in. We appreciate it. Until next week, this is Amanda Vanstone saying see you later. Thank you.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.